Hello and welcome to another edition of Living with Dying. This is the podcast where we talk about all aspects to do with death and dying. And today I'm interviewing Catherine Beer, who I've spoken to a couple of times before, but we're changing the subject a bit today, aren't we, Catherine?
We are.
Since we last met, you've trained as a celebrant,
I know
that, for funerals.
Yes.
And also as a doula,
I think. I have.
So let's start with the work as a celebrant. What led you into this in the first place?
Well, thanks for having me again, Dilys. It's so lovely to see you and be part of this podcast series. Just to slightly recap, I left my role as pastoral care worker at Thames Hospice in March of 24 and had a little bit of a sabbatical, and then went and did my training in October last year as an independent funeral celebrant. And so I did my training with the Fellowship of Professional Celebrants, and that was with Terry Negus, who's amazing and absolutely brilliant independent celebrant for over 20 years. And that was an incredibly powerful course, and we looked at lots of different ways of being a celebrant, of learning about the role, writing eulogies, meeting the families, talking with them and getting alongside them at a really poignant, pivotal time of life, really. We looked at the fact that funerals that as celebrants we would take would not be always be a traditional funeral of someone who is elderly. Obviously, there are lots of different reasons as to why people die. So we looked at the more sensitive funerals that we might be taking and just learnt about how each funeral is unique, each person who has died is unique, whatever their age, and that person deserves a really special funeral that's very personal to them. And so it's been a way that I have been able to get back alongside people who are grieving and who are hurting and to walk along a part of their journey with them. As an independent funeral celebrant, we are really fortunate that we sort of sit in the middle of vicars or priests who will take their religious ceremonies. And then on the other side, you have humanist celebrants who will be absolutely non-religious, non-spiritual. And so we're in the middle. We can do either or. Mm. And so it's really interesting because when I go and meet the family, one of my questions would be, let's just choose a name, did Fred have any beliefs or philosophy on life or life after death? And so I can tease out how the person felt and whether there was any interest in spirituality or faith. And therefore, if they want that incorporated, then I can do that. And I'm very comfortable with incorporating anything religious into a funeral service. You know, I took one recently where they wanted to have a prayer, they wanted to have a hymn, they wanted a particular poem that had, it was Footprints in the Sand, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with. But there was no consistent religious input for him. He just thought there was something there afterwards. And so it's about learning what was important to that person and therefore what is important to the family, and how can we tell the story of your person in a way that pays tribute to them and honours them and brings their personality into the service.
So what kinds of different people, different age groups, different categories of people have you had the privilege of conducting funerals for?
So far, actually, most of my funerals have been for older people, but it's been such a privilege. It is a privilege because, you know, although I had never met the person, obviously, before the funeral, to be invited into someone's home, to talk to them, to learn more about them, you know, I have questions that I will ask. But it's not just about asking questions, it's about hearing and listening to what the relatives are telling me and picking out the individual quirks, sense of humour, what makes that person unique to that family, and how can we tell the story of a life well lived.
Isn't it quite daunting going into a home when you know everybody's in that deep state of grief that they don't want to be in at all?
It can be. But what drives me is my passion, my heart for being alongside people who are hurting. And, you and I have discussed over the different episodes that we've done about how important it is to talk about somebody who's died, even in those early days. Because in those early days, there is always a sense of shock, isn't there? Whether you knew the death was coming or not, there's that shock. And a lot of people need to talk about the person who's just died. And I'm going there specifically for them to talk about that person. And so that my first point of contact with them can be anything, maybe 2 hours, maybe more, because it's important that I give them that time and I listen and I learn what I need to pick out. I'm scrawling away while they're talking to me, and I do explain that. It can feel a bit unnatural when someone's talking to, I'm writing everything down that they're saying, but actually it's for their good, because we need to tell this story and I need to tell it correctly and in a way that they find helpful. So it can be daunting because you don't quite know what you're going to walk into in the house. But what I have found is that there's always laughter as well as the tears.
Strange that, isn't it? They're very close together, aren't they? Laughter and tears.
I can remember someone saying to me quite a few years ago when her husband died, laughter and tears are strangely sitting side by side. And I've used that a lot because you can be crying and within seconds laughing. And I do find that that happens quite a lot when I go and see a family and meet them.
How did they find you?
So far, they find me through their funeral director. So I'm registered with 5 of my local funeral directors. I'm also registered on the website of the Fellowship of Professional Celebrants. So you can find your own celebrant yourself by looking online, or you will go with the funeral directors. Most funeral directors will have quite a large number of celebrants who they work with. And I think that's right, because not every celebrant is going to be suited to every family. There's going to be differences. And I think the funeral director is very skilled in learning, or so and so may be really good for this family. I think there's some connections there. I'll ask that celebrant to be conducting that funeral. So I'm very much guided by the funeral director when they call me.
Does that mean you could work in a crematorium, or you could work in a church, or you could work at an open air burial? I mean, anywhere?
So a celebrant, I can conduct a funeral wherever the family would choose to have that service. So far the funerals I've conducted have been in a crematorium, but there's graveside burials. I might conduct a service there, woodland burials, or in a church. If they wanted a celebrant to be part of the service along with a vicar, then I can be part of that. It's about learning what do the family want, because this is for the family, this is for their loved one, their relative, friend who's died, and it's about what's right for them. And so all their choices of music, of poems, songs or hymns, whichever their preference is to have or not to have, they don't have to have any music. It's all about what they want. So, someone might say to me, "Oh, do you think that song was a little bit odd for us to have chosen?" No. If that's what you'd like, then that's what we'll have. And so it's really being guided. I'm guided by the family.
It's a very important role, isn't it? And it seems strange to me that quite often the person conducting the funeral doesn't actually know the person who's died. And I think I might have told this story before on one of my episodes, but I remember going to the funeral of an elderly aunt many years ago when the vicar got her name wrong and obviously didn't know her and
No.
didn't work hard enough to get to know her. And I was shocked at that. I've never forgotten that. That
No,
stayed with me.
I can imagine. And I think, that is naturally, that's a fear for celebrants, that you will not have the name right. it's one of the most important things we have to do, because this is paying respectful tribute to the person who has died. That person was a human being and needs the respect of a funeral service that honours them for themselves, but also for the family and the friends. And that's why the meeting that I have with each family is absolutely pivotal. It's vital that I get it right. I have to get this right, because this is the family's one and last chance of saying it's a final goodbye.
Honouring their loved one.
Absolutely.
And saying goodbye.
Absolutely. And being very individual. And I know that, you know, we learnt on our training that all funerals have a right to be individual. So although we tend to follow the same sort of format, and there are things that we sort of stick to with entry, exit. If we're in a crematorium, then we will have the committal with the curtains. But again, it's the family's choice if they want the curtains open or being closed during the service. So it's even to those details, whether they have a photograph up of their loved one next to the coffin, whether they want items that were really unique to that person. So if there was a sport that the person loved, would you like to have some of those things on or around the coffin at the time? You know, and there are other things like, would you like to, as you leave the creme, would you like to come and lay a flower on the coffin? There are lots of different ways in which a service can be made unique. And Terry Negus, who did my training, talked about a funeral that she took of a young child, 7 or 8, I think. And in the order of service, she had put, obviously this had been discussed with the family, a little sticky note. And so towards the end of the service, there was some quiet reflection time. You could write a little message. And then as you left the creme, you just stick it on the coffin as a final goodbye message. Oh. And there are lots of different ways in which a funeral can be really unique and really memorable, despite the sadness.
I know you've worked in hospice care and this kind of area for a long time. But nonetheless, it feels like a slightly strange choice of career. I mean, don't people say to you, isn't it depressing?
I have that quite a lot. And why do you want to be immersed in working with death and dying all the time? Is it depressing? Don't you find it morbid? And I don't actually. I find it quite a beautiful privilege, because, you know, having experienced the death of my father 10 years ago and the deaths of fairly close friends over the past few years, we can't ever get away from the fact that death is going to happen, can we? Birth and death are the two certainties of life. And people will say, oh, no, I can't talk about death and dying. Oh, no, it's far too... No. And I do respect that. But for me, what drives me to be this sort of person, to reach out to others, is because I've had positive experiences of death, which I think you can have. It might sound like a contradiction in terms. You can have a positive experience of death. I understand and accept it's not always the way. I do get that. Sudden tragic death is brutal, and that's not going to be positive. But actually, what I can do, and what others who can do in this role, or any role supporting people who are bereaved, is we can be in that with them and hold them and be close to them as they go through either a positive experience of death or a brutal experience of death. Either way, you're not on your own, and people like myself and others in this sort of supportive role can be alongside you. And that's what drives me. And ultimately for me, it's a privilege. It's a really beautiful privilege to be with people when they're hurting, when they're grieving, and be what I need to be for them at the time.
It's something very special, isn't it, that you're giving people, really?
Yeah, I think so.
And we mentioned earlier on that you've trained as a doula.
Yes.
And I guess that's going to change your career slightly, is it? Because you might end up knowing the people that you're conducting services for.
That is my vision, is that, so as we've said, that I've just completed my foundation training in being an end-of-life death doula. And I know that last summer you did a podcast series episode with someone who had also trained as a doula, didn't you? And she'd set up and was very interested to listen to her podcast. Because again, it's a position that you draw alongside people again. And so it would just be a wonderful opportunity to have walked the journey with somebody and with their family. And then hopefully, if they would allow me to move into conducting their funeral, because I would have had an opportunity to get to know that person for myself. And I think, you know, I learnt this at the hospice, when you are with somebody who is facing the end of their life, it is an incredible experience, because you are opened up to how they are viewing things, and they let you into their inner soul quite often. And sometimes they don't do that to anybody else. And sometimes people have talked to me about things that they won't have talked to about anybody else. And so for me, being given the opportunity to be a doula, to be alongside people, and then see that through to the final goodbye, would be just an overwhelming privilege for me.
It would complete the circle, wouldn't it? It would mean funerals weren't conducted all the time by people who didn't know the dead person, but by people who did, which would be great.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when my father died, we were very fortunate, because he was a minister, so he was retired, so he was part of a church. Mum and Dad's minister took that funeral, and so he knew my dad, and that made such a difference. And I think that, you know, as much as I strive to feel that I have got to know the person through the families telling me of stories, it's not quite the same, obviously, as if I had met the person. So my vision is to incorporate the two roles together. And then that would just be, as you say, completing the circle.
So tell me more then about being a doula. What exactly is involved? How do people go about finding a doula, and what do you actually do?
Yeah. So it's a role that is growing over here. I did my training with an organisation called Living Well, Dying Well, and they are a sister company to End of Life Doula UK. And to practice as a doula, you do this, the foundation training. You're then registered on the End of Life Doula UK website, but none of your personal details, contact details, are on there. So if someone was looking for a doula, wanting to have a doula alongside them at that point, they would contact the organisation, tell them where they lived, what they were looking for. The person who would answer the phone would talk them through the role, talk them through sort of the charges that a particular doula may ask for, and then link them with a doula in their area, and then give me the details, and I would make the contact with the family. And then my way I would choose to work is that I would want to go and meet the family, for them to get to know me a little bit, and for me to get to know them a little bit, and let's find out, what is it you're looking for? How can I be alongside you? What's important to you? What are you looking to get out of our relationship together? And then if we felt we could work together, then we would put that in motion. And being a death doula doesn't always mean that you will only be working with somebody and supporting somebody as they approach their death. So a family may well want to get in contact with the doula organisation, because they've had, someone within their family has had a life-limiting diagnosis, and they would like emotional support as they all process, as they all decide, how will we move forwards through this? How can we manage? But also for practical support. So it may well have brought them all into the point of thinking, oh my goodness, we haven't got anything in place practically. And so part of the role of being a doula is equipping them to know, how can we be ready? How can you be ready? So looking at wills, do you have a will? If not, okay, let's look for a solicitor who can take care of your will for you. Do you think you might want a power of attorney? In fact, most people should have a power of attorney. So let's look at putting that in place. Let's look at life as it moves forward. How does that look for you? What other things do you think you might like to have? So let's look at hopes and wishes. How would you like your end of life care to be? What would it look like for you? Where would you like to be? So putting a hopes and wishes plan together, putting a funeral plan together. What's important for you at your funeral? How would you like it to be? How would you like to leave instructions for your family, or would you not like to leave instructions? This is all about listening to the person at the centre. It's person-centred. It has to be guided by them. Looking at what's important to you spiritually, are there spiritual elements that you would like to be included? Do you follow a particular faith? If so, how can I support you in carrying that out as life progresses and as time moves forwards? So you may well come alongside a family right at the very beginning of a diagnosis and start working at their pace and at what's important for them. They may well have things then put in place and feel, I feel quite steady and stable now, so I might withdraw. They then might contact me as time moves forwards and say, actually, can you come back on board? Things are moving forwards. We'd like more support. So it's a bit of an open-ended piece of work time-wise, and it would cover all sorts. It may well be that you have a doula at the house as time is getting shorter. And what's important to the family for a doula to do is, can you make cups of tea? Can you take the dog for a walk? Or could you go to the shops and fill up so we can be family? So we can just be with our loved one. They might want you to actually be present as the end approaches. They might not want you to be there. So it's really about listening to the family, listening to the person concerned, and really being guided by them.
And is part of it to help explain to them what might happen? Because I think that's the biggest fear we all have, isn't it? If you haven't witnessed a death, you haven't been close to someone who's died, it's the great fear of the unknown, isn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely. And it's about helping them to understand what to expect, as you say, and not being frightened by what may happen, and just talking with them about how can we tell. Some people will say, how do we know it's happening? How do we know when it's coming? Okay, so let's look at that. These are what you might see. These are how you might be able to help your loved one manage what's happening to them. And just guiding them, really guiding them through experience and reassurance. Reassurance that, you know, okay, so there may be a throaty noise that you might hear towards the end. Don't be fearful. That's something you may see. We'll manage.
It sounds like you're mostly there then for the family rather than for the person who's dying. Or have I got that slightly wrong?
I suppose it's both, really, because in the sort of moving towards, if we're talking about the time that's heading towards end of life, my main focus would be the person concerned, I think, because what is right for you? What's important for you? If there is disagreement, or the person concerned and the family are not on the same page, then that's quite a navigation, because what you want to do, your aim is to bring everybody together so that they all journey through this together on the same page. That can be quite tough, because the person who is ill may be very clear about what they do and don't want, They might have chosen, no more treatment. I can't take it anymore. I want to have quality. And that may mean their time is shortened considerably. The family, through shock, through grief, through pain, may not agree with that. And so it's a really careful way of helping everyone to get on the same page. As the person who is not well moves forwards in time and life gets shorter, they will become unresponsive. They will cease communicating, but they're still living. And so again, it moves into a different level of navigation about explaining and guiding family. Yes, I can tell you're upset. Yes, I can see this grief is really hitting. Let's not talk about things in front of your loved one. They'll hear you. Let's take that conversation outside. Let's talk about it. Let me listen to your grief. Let me listen to your pain. Let me be here and just listen. And then let's go back in and let's talk to your loved one, because they are still living up to the moment they take that last breath. And so I suppose it's, you know, going back to your question about the person or the family, it's a scale. It goes up and down on both sides, because I'm there for everybody, but ultimately I have to respect the wishes of the person who's not well.
I can see it as being the coming thing, really, because so many people are, as I said earlier, scared about what happens at the end. And we don't get much information, do we?
No.
There aren't many places we can find out about it.
No.
So the idea of having someone like you on hand to call when needed and to come and explain things to the family, to the person themselves, it sounds a fabulous idea.
And I think it will grow in popularity. Sure, that's the right word, but you know what I mean. I think, because you know, there's amazing provision of hospices. I mean, phenomenal, aren't we blessed with our hospices? But not everybody wants to be in a hospice, and sadly, not everyone can get into a hospice if it's full. But actually, if people are at home either through choice or because they can't get a bed in a hospice, then to have somebody to come alongside the family, but also the medical team, because, you know, medical teams in hospices and in the community are phenomenal. But it's about working alongside. You know, doulas are not medical, we're not clinical, and we're not there to take away the role of the medical team at all. It's about working alongside people. It's about being a team around the patient and the family.
You're probably helping the medical people as well, aren't you? Because you're taking that load away from them, really, that psychological care, really, away
from them. Yes, yes, and that's where it works so well in the hospice. You know, when I was there, the medical team would call on the pastoral care team quite often to work alongside them in meetings, in conversations, and sometimes to come into the room to pick up a conversation, and the medical team would withdraw. And so therefore we would then pick up where that conversation had stopped from a medical perspective. How has that left you feeling? What can I be? How do you need me to be?
It's a fascinating area.
It is.
And as one of my previous guests, Toby Porter of Hospice UK, was explaining to me the other day, we are going to have an enormous surge in people dying in the next 10 or 15 years. Mm. So I imagine your role will become even more useful.
I think it's definitely something that is growing, you know, to learn about how to be ready, how to be prepared. If something happened to you tomorrow that meant you couldn't communicate, do your family know how you do or don't want to be cared for? And I think a lot of people would say, oh, no. And, you know, it's extreme, but none of us do know what's going to happen tomorrow. And once people have got their practical plans in place, you can put them in a filing box and then you don't need to think about it anymore. I know what drove you when you started your podcast series about let's make this a natural conversation. Let's help to take some fear away from people. Because, you know, just by saying, should we do our will? Should we get a power of attorney in place? Doesn't mean to say that we will die tomorrow. But that's, I think, where people's fears are. If I talk about it, it's going to happen. But it's something we are, it's going to happen to all of us. Like we've said a little while ago, birth and death, the two certainties. And we prepare so much for a birth or the arrival of a child into a family. However that child arrives into a family, we prepare, we plan, we celebrate. But death. But
the big thing, the big event.
Yeah.
We don't.
No. And I also think that, you know, another thing that I'm very keen for people not to experience was maybe things that I found difficult. And I think we all do that, don't we, in with experience. If we've had a negative experience and we have an opportunity to change that for people further down the line and in the future, then we endeavour to do that, don't we? And that's another thing for me, is that I had a good experience of death and I want people to experience that. I also had things that I would never want people to experience. And so I want to try and be part of the changing the tide, changing the flow of things. And I'm more than happy to be approached by anybody who's listened to the podcast and would like to talk anything through or to find out a little bit more about the role of a doula and the role of a funeral celebrant. I'm happy to be contacted by email, Catherine@alwaysandbeyond.co.uk.
Always and beyond.
Yeah, always and beyond support through life, death and grief.
Catherine, thank you ever so much for talking to me again.
Thank you, Dilys.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.